Welcome to Uncommon Sense, a podcast that meets at the crossroads of banking, risk management, and the regulation of financial markets. I am your host, Tommy Esposito. Uncommon Sense is named in honor of Thomas Paine, who wrote the pamphlet Common Sense, which was published in 1776 and is jam-packed with amazing quotes. At the beginning of every podcast, I'd like to read a quote from Paine's pamphlet. Here is today's quote. Could the struggling thoughts of individuals be collected, they would frequently form materials for wise and able men to improve into useful matter. End quote. Let us try then to find useful matter from our conversation today. I would like to introduce my very special guest, Mr. Brian Esposito. Brian is my brother. He is also Vice President of Partnerships for Spectra, a division of Comcast Spectacor. His office is in the Wells Fargo Center, home of the 76ers and Flyers. If you've ever seen the Blue Indigo Bikes in Philadelphia, which is the city's bike-sharing partnership with Independence Blue Cross, Brian is responsible. He's worked with NBC's Golf Channel, the Breeders' Cup, the Arizona Coyotes of the NHL, Arena Football, and many other sports organizations. Brian has worked previously in sponsorship sales for the Philadelphia Eagles. Today, Brian and I will talk about Foles versus Wentz, post-COVID life in the city, the future of live events, and life lessons learned from playing sports. I hope you enjoy our conversation. And thank you for listening. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that when I was preparing for this today and preparing for a podcast in general, what really occurred to me was the reason I wanted you to be my first guest is because when we were young kids, when I was, I think, 9 or 10 years old, for Christmas, I received this box. We called it a box. It was a Sony box, had two speakers and a tape deck in the middle, and it had a teeny little microphone on it. So you could put the tape, like a blank tape in and record. And the first thing I did was do an interview show with you. And I believe it was called Channel Doo Doo News because we just thought anything related to that term was funny. And I believe the first question I asked you was if you were weird, and you said no. So it had to be you for the first guest because
it had to be.
I am not weird. And that was okay. End of story. We stopped the tape. I rolled it back and listened to myself and you and thought it was an absolute miracle. Right. And here we are with our phones and our earbuds and our computers and everything. My, has technology progressed. But that's it. We share quite a bit.
That's funny. I have vivid memories of probably sitting on the floor in someone's bedroom and recording, you know, recording in that box that you got, which we thought was the greatest, you know, Christmas gift ever up until that point.
And we were doing mixtapes where we would record bits of radio and then I would talk over it and say, this song stinks. Let me flip the channel. And then I would click it again. And like it was this early, you know, mixtape, which then evolved in the high school years into, you know, making mixtapes for girlfriends and all that stuff. But you and I have had this debate for years, and that is, and it's easy to debate it now because of Wentz kind of flaming out. But after they won the Super Bowl, I never understood why the Eagles gave up on Foles and gave the ball back to Wentz, even though Foles was the guy that put him over the top. And I don't know if you have any insight based on the organizational culture of the Eagles, why they chose that way. I know a lot of fans said, well, Wentz won 12 games or something. And then, you know, but then in the second year, Foles again triumph took a 9-7 team and nearly carried them again to the Super Bowl, and they made the call to go with Wentz. And it's I think that's something that's a kind of a leadership point, is
you know, how do you make that call? You know, when you're in that position where a sub comes in, kicks butt, do you let him have the ball as a leader, or do you go back with your draft pick? It's easy to play armchair, but my opinion was very old school sports. If somebody steps up, it's like the whole, you know, Lou Gehrig versus Wally Pipp. You know, Wally Pipp gets hurt, Lou Gehrig steps in. Hey, he's got the ball, you know?
Yeah.
Give him the ball. But
yeah,
I didn't get the whole thinking around Wentz. I don't know if you have – I know you have an opinion on this, so.
Well, you know, listen, I as a fan, right, I mean, you could go back and forth. And, you know, there was just something about Nick Foles and the magic that he brought to the team and the way he was able to lead him. Look, he's an icon in Philadelphia for the Super Bowl win, and that to me is enough. You know, just because what a great run was. But, you know, you put a lot of stock in a younger guy and you know, you think he's really going to have, maybe has more upside and they went that way. You know, look, in the time that that's all happened, you know, things have kind of gotten even crazier, you know, with the Eagles and especially now
with Peterson gone. Peterson's there.
But just as a fan, I mean, I was always kind of on the fence with the whole Foles Wentz, and I maybe leaned towards Wentz because maybe I thought he had a little more upside and was playing so well prior to getting hurt in that Super Bowl year. But I think that's just part of being a fan, having these types of debates and picking sides, I guess, in a sense.
Do you think part of that?
Yeah, I think that's just part of.
Do you think part of that was the fact that we so overanalyze now with data and analytics? And we've gotten away from sort of the instinct of, like, you know, I just feel like if this decision was made in the 60s, right, and it was Johnny Unitas versus the guy he replaced with the Baltimore Colts, I guess that's the 50s, you know, in that era, Johnny Unitas was the backup. He stepped up and he was freaking Johnny Unitas, you know, and then he took over. And you know, like, he won the big game. They gave him the ball, you know, and that was always my thinking.
Well, I think these are the game has changed, right? Like, professional sports have changed. These are billion-dollar businesses.
I know, right?
You know, hundreds of million-dollar businesses. Whereas, you know, then it was a couple guys owned a team and they played in a league. So, you know, data analytics is going to come into play just because the dollars and cents kind of,
and the agents and the contracts and all that money. And, you know, but there's still, even in the modern era, you know, the example of Drew Bledsoe and Tom Brady. Tom Brady was Bledsoe's backup. Bledsoe got hurt. Brady stepped in, did really well. You know, like, again, it's a tough call, but I still always thought they should have stuck with Foles. I know we can disagree on this, but you're making great points. That adds a level of pressure to the decision maker, which is all this contracts, money, the business of the fact that the fans were buying more Wentz shirts than they were Foles shirts. I'm sure they had all that data when they were deciding what to do.
It's a debate that will go on forever, right? There's those that were Foles guys and goals that were Wentz guys, but ultimately, hey, say what you will, but they won a Super Bowl with Nick Foles and that's pretty,
and
fun,
nobody
right?
would have argued with that if he'd gone that route. But anyway, it's so speaking of the parade in Philadelphia, you're a guy who's lived in the city for quite a number of years. You've invested, you bought an apartment, a 2-floor apartment in an area where it was all Section 8 housing, you know, years ago. And in the past, 10 years, it's sort of turning over one by one and building new apartments. So you've watched sort of the urban transformation happen. And, you know, this is such a pivotal moment for, you know, people in my industry who are trying to figure out what's going to happen in these northeastern cities like Philadelphia, like New York. Will these young professionals, due to the COVID, due to the fact that we're all working online so much, people are working from home using their Wi-Fi signals and not going into an office space, you know, will people continue to live in the city, or will they, you know, fly out to, you know, ex-urban areas or suburban areas and just begin to migrate there and, you know, have big offices at home? So it's sort of this raging debate because we're trying to figure out how to value some of these properties that are empty because people have just left. And I wanted to get your view as somebody who is a true blue urban dweller who loves living in the city, you've sold your car a couple of years ago and you commute, or you were commuting to your office in South Philadelphia on the subway, right? So what are your thoughts on that right now from your personal view?
Yeah, I mean, just from my perspective, I mean, it's, you know, look, we love being in the city, because of the amenities and the walkability. And, you know, I think that, you know, those are the types of things when you look at what's going on now that are almost kind of taken away, right? Like the positives and the reasons why you live in a city such as this is because of the good restaurants and the bars and the walkability and, hey, I can, you know, walk to the grocery store. I can walk here or there. And, you know, a lot of that's been kind of taken away. And so the benefits are no longer here. And so in the current state, you know, it makes it challenging and to not have those things that you can really do. And, you know, I think what happens from here is probably too early to tell. I think there was an influx of people coming to the cities and the marketplace was aggressive and, home values were increasing. All these things were happening leading up to the pandemic. And whether they continue to do so, I don't know. I think, you know, from our perspective, we were like a lot of people, you know, young professionals who wanted all of those benefits of a city and, the walkability, all those things I talked about, and will that remain? I think it probably remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But obviously the trend was, you know, that these are the things that young people really, really wanted, didn't want to, you know, have a car, wanted to be able to walk. I mean, I'm almost 3 years, you know, of not having a car. And, you know, we do have one car. We got rid of the second one and taking the subway every day to me was easy. You know, you walk to school, you get your steps, I mean, you walk to work, you get your steps in and you take the subway, and it was easy and convenient. And I enjoyed it. It you know, for me that worked, you know, having not done that in, I guess it's been 10 months now, you know, there's a part of me that kind of misses it, but whether that changes in the future, I don't know. But I think it probably has more to do with what, you know, what personal preferences young people have, and do they keep that interest in being in urban areas and having that kind of urban experience? I guess that remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said for the fact that younger professionals, people who are, you know, the millennial generation and younger, are so committed to the climate change topic. They, you know, they're pushing for battery powered cars. They're pushing for green energy. They want to get rid of coal. And I think that this is what's driving this urban renewal, that young professionals want to live in cities because they're passionate about changing the way we live to a more efficient lifestyle where walkability is possible. So I think they're motivated by altruistic things, not necessarily, oh, I just want to go to the corner cafe and hang out with my friends. I think it's that too. But I also think there's this sort of motivation of like, this is sort of like a value check for them or a virtue signaling that is deep and powerful, that's been affected through their education. I don't think that's going to go away. So I think whether if we do see migration out of the cities, they're going to want to congregate in areas where they can get that walkability. So the other thing I do think, and at least what I'm reading about and seeing, is that the really most expensive cities, Boston, New York, San Francisco, they're seeing huge drops in average rents, 20, 25, 30% drops, because people are leaving those areas and they're migrating to secondary, what we call secondary cities. Philadelphia is one of those. Philly is a large urban area that is relatively very affordable compared to like a New York or Boston. So I don't think Philly is going to get hurt. I think in the long run, once we come out of this pandemic and things get back to some sort of semblance of normal, you know, when the cases sort of fall and we learn to live with it, I think it's going to come back. I that's just my take. I think prices actually have already dropped to the point where it will be more affordable for people who may not have been able to afford it, and they'll jump on it. You are in the live event business. And obviously we've had a massive disruption in that field. And I wanted to know if you had anything you think you could share about the current prevailing sort of wisdom about where we're headed with live events and sports. When do you think we'll see people going back to stadiums again, watching the Phillies, watching the Sixers, the Flyers in the arenas? Like, do you have any sense right now? Is there any kind of planning going on and saying, yeah, by August we're going to be back or anything like that? Or is it still a wide open?
I think it's still pretty wide open. I think, you know, and you kind of felt this throughout, you know, most venues are really, really subject to the regulations placed upon them by their states or municipalities and whatnot. You know, you saw some teams in the NFL that would allow certain numbers of fans at events, obviously at a small proportion. You saw a lot of college football in certain parts of the country where, you know, fans, you know, in some cases, you know, the venue was a third full or, you know, maybe even slightly more. You know, I think, look, what the future holds is probably still TBD.
Yeah.
It is a little easier for the outdoor venues, obviously, than the indoor venues, but, you know, we're starting to see, you know, some of the leagues just, you know, start playing in their home venues, which is encouraging. And, you know, the fans, you know, I think obviously the vaccine's probably going to have a lot to do with that. So it's just hard to predict. And then personal preference and personal comfort level. But I think the one thing I would say is that you're going to see a lot more like processes and procedures put into place to make the experience more comfortable in this kind of call it new post-COVID world. And by that, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things that we're seeing is contactless engagement really from beginning to end of an event. You know, we're seeing more and more companies pop up that offer certain technologies that, you know, allow you to go to an event and in some ways not even touch, you know, really come into contact with anybody. You know, that includes contactless parking. So, you know, reserving parking spots beforehand or payment solutions where, you know, you know, utilizing your smartphone, you can just, you know, you don't really need to, you know, there's no cash transaction, contactless ticketing. I mean, this is something that you've already started to see, but
yeah,
you know, more and more venues going the route of, you know, that you just, you know, your ticket populates on your phone and you have a barcode and you go in. Contactless concessions is something that we're seeing with in-venue apps and texting platforms where you literally could just order on your phone, pay it on your phone, and then like pick it up, right? And or even some cases have it delivered to your seat. We're seeing, you know, that as a potential opportunity. So, you know, and even further, contactless, you know, bathrooms, right? You know, that's something that maybe you've seen, but I think you're going to see more of that where, you know, the stalls and things will flush without having to touch them. So I think there's a shift that was maybe happening anyways, that just happened quicker, that is a more contactless, you know, experience, you know, for fans. And I think that's going to be something that people, patrons, fans, you know, are going to want and venues are going to provide, they're going to continue to provide. I mean, some of the newer buildings are seeing that, but, and then the other thing I would add is, you know, could potentially see more options for premium spaces. If there's, you know, if certain fans want more personal space, less interaction with crowds, for those that want it. Some of these things, you know, have been happening anyways, but, you know, I think ultimately, you know, venues that host concerts, events, sporting events, what have you, you know, they're really going to have to go, they're going to have to do things to provide these types of resources and options for fans if they want to attract them and make it a more comfortable experience. So some of the stuff, like I said, has been happening, but I think it's just going to happen quicker in this call it new COVID world.
It's so interesting you say that, because this is exactly the kind of stuff that you hear being talked about in terms of e-commerce versus the traditional retail. You know, that this whole COVID business and its aftermath has caused this rapid acceleration of what was already coming in industry by industry. So you see malls diminishing. People are buying more on Amazon and other platforms like this. There's going to be a lot more direct-to-consumer purchasing. And this is something that was coming, but now people through this process have just accelerated buying food on an app and then just going and picking it up, you know, like, or getting it delivered. And I think what you're describing totally makes sense. You know, why can't we go contactless into a, you know, into, you know, Citizens Bank Park to watch a Phillies game, and, you know, with the proper level of security and ensuring people aren't cheating their way into the building and all that kind of stuff, parking, everything you described makes total sense and allows people to get, have that greater comfort. And it's probably where things were heading anyway, this sort of automation, which is underlying so much of the technology innovations of the last, say, 10 years. So very, very interesting and really good points. And again, just you saying those things makes me feel more comfortable about taking, you know, my kids to a Phillies game. If we get there, I can't imagine people wouldn't be more comfortable. You know, maybe you go from a 25% full to a 50% full, and then from 50 to 75 and then 75, you know, there'll be a process, but really, really interesting.
Look, I mean, playing sports as much as we did, you know, at such a young age, into high school and such, you know, that competition, I still draw on, right? Being in that arena and, you know, even though it's, you know, in quiet gyms somewhere and you're competing for something that's, you know, maybe not that significant. For us in that arena of competition, you know, you just develop life lessons. And I still draw on that. And I think, it really helps in times like this. You know, look, there's a business partner of ours that that I work with who has a signature at on the back of his email that says, "Adversity does not build character, it reveals it." Right. And so I think, you know, that's something that I sort of look at is hopefully, you know, you build a foundation in difficult times like this so that, you know, eventually they're going to come to pass and you're going to move forward. But you know, I think, again, to your point, drawing on those experiences is something that I do all the time. And, you know, playing sports is, I think, has really benefited me, especially in sales, which is a very competitive environment and something where you're going to win and you're going to lose more than you win. And it's like, you know, it's like baseball, right? You know, the best hitters in baseball hit the ball, get hits 30% of the time. So you're getting, you know, you're not getting a hit 70%. So, you know, I draw on that a lot in sales, and it's a, you know, it's a big, I think it's really sort of benefited me as I've kind of grown.
Thanks to my brother, Brian, for being my first guest. This podcast is sponsored by Veligan Blacksall Consultants, a national firm providing risk management and consulting services to banks, credit unions, and fintech companies. A link is provided below. Look out for our next podcast soon. Thank you for listening and have a great day. Cheers.